Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. My guest for this morning is Chitoka Webb. From a humble beginning, as a daughter of a single mother holding her family together in the Nashville housing projects, Chitoka has risen to become the CEO of several companies, a motivational speaker, and an author. The dynamic of the story is that she accomplishes all of these in her mid-30s. Chitoka and I will be discussing her life's journey and her new memoir titled Something Inside of Me, which has a nationwide release date of July the 1st. It is a poignant, funny, and inspiring story about her life. Good morning, Chitoka. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I am doing great. And good morning to you, Johnny. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. I really enjoyed reading your book. It's very inspirational and motivating.
Excellent.
Congratulations on being an author.
Thank you. It's a long road, but it was so well worth it. You know, as I was writing the book, I actually learned a lot more about myself than I actually knew.
Fantastic.
But it was a great experience. I'm so glad you enjoyed it.
It was a wonderful book. It's very inspirational and certainly very, very motivating, and it's definitely a must read for everyone that looks for some inspirational story to help them. When I read your book, it reminded me on a lot of things that I've done. And, Johnny, you need to get started to do this. So it's a wonderful thing. So let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. I was born in 1974, December the 18th, to be exact, in the Nashville Housing Projects, Preston Taylor Housing Projects. I was raised by my mother, she was a single parent. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that my mom used to do, used to teach us as children, even on up until we became adults, is she used to always have this saying, and that saying was to treat everyone the way that you want to be treated. And one of the reasons why I make an effort to make sure that I state that, you know, quite often, is because sometimes when you mention the housing projects, mm-hmm. people think that you grew up in a hole or mm-hmm. in this miserable, dark place. And as I point out in the very beginning of the book, while, you know, the housing projects was riddled, you know, with low-income families and crime, there was a lot of good things going on. You know, that's where I learned to share. It's where I learned, you know, to get mad and get over it within a day, because back then, you know, two kids could be arguing on the basketball court, but then in the next hour they would be friends again. Mm-hmm. So I always, you know, try to make sure that I mention that. But I had a very, very supportive mother. She's, you know, supportive now, but, you know, especially throughout my childhood. And my mother was very big on taking responsibilities for your actions. And what kind of puzzled me as a child is that requirement that she had, it did not waver. Even when maybe I was in the right, maybe someone mm-hmm. done something to me that mm-hmm. they were not supposed to do, that requirement of taking responsibility for that situation and moving on was still there. Mm-hmm. And so learning that at an early age, it really gave me a good sense, you know, to be in tune to other people's feelings, other people's thoughts. So I've always had that natural knack, I would say, mm-hmm. for, you know, making sure that I didn't step on anybody's toes, respecting them, their wishes, their thoughts, their beliefs, and so forth. But not only did that one particular principle lead to me making good decisions, it also led to great work ethics. Mm-hmm. So at the age of 13, because, you know, we were really poor,
right,
and barely had enough to make it, I always had this urge to make money, you know, even if it was, you know, cleaning my aunt's house when I was a child or folding my grandmother's laundry, just mm-hmm. knowing that I could work and be paid for it was like the best dream for me as a kid. You know, I never mm-hmm. prayed mm-hmm. for dolls and toys and cute little boyfriends. I wanted mm-hmm. to work. And so at 13, I landed my first job at Kroger's, which is a grocery shopping mart here in mm-hmm. Nashville. I think it's a nationwide chain. So I landed my first yes. job there at 13, and everything was going really well. I would arrive to work like 30 minutes early, and I always wanted to work overtime and see if I could work on the weekends. And one day, I'll never forget it, it was on a Sunday, and my seventh grade math teacher, mm-hmm. her name was Miss Burrows, and she came through my line. And I felt like I was a robber who had been caught. And so, because she knew that I wasn't 16. Mm-hmm. And so she came through the line, and she, you know how sometimes older women can give you this look like, now you know better.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she came through the line, she gave me that look. She never said a word. She paid for her groceries. But I had to go to school that next morning to see her, and I was just so afraid that she was going to tell the Kroger company that I was 13.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
that night, you made up some kind of story and told the supervisor that I had to quit. But it was a learning experience for me, you know, especially at such a young age,
mm-hmm.
because I realized that, you know, like the principle that my mother was trying to teach me, when you take responsibility for the things that are within your control, they can only help you. So I learned great work ethics just in those 8 months, you know,
mm-hmm.
because when I started, mm-hmm. I was a cashier. I mean, I was a courtesy clerk, which is a bagger.
Mm-hmm.
And within 2 months, because I would arrive on time and my clothes were nicely pressed and they were clean and I was respectful,
mm-hmm.
I was promoted to cashier. And it was kind of weird because I was like super young and most of the cashiers were like in their 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really didn't want to let the job go, but I had to let it go because I was afraid she was going to tell on me. But so you know, throughout my teenage years, I worked at different fast food restaurants, nursing homes, and I really got a feel for understanding the importance of great service.
Mm-hmm.
Even when a customer may have came into a restaurant and maybe their order was incorrect or the food was old or cold or whatever, most people just want what they pay for. They don't want any trouble. And so I learned just through those different experiences that taking the time to speak with someone about their order and correcting it, I always got really good results. So, you know, early on, I just learned the importance of working with people, trying to understand where they're coming from. And because I had received such good results from doing that, I realized as I got older, actually before I started my business, that that's really the key to success,
mm-hmm.
is being respectful of other people's feelings and treating all people, whether you know them or whether you don't know them, but treating all people the way that you want to be treated. And it goes both ways, whether, you know, maybe you've done something wrong to them or maybe they've done something wrong to you, because what happens is when you treat people the way that you want to be treated, something is liberated
mm-hmm.
into the atmosphere, and it allows the universe to continue moving on, you know. And so so I started my first business at 24 years old, but I actually started working for myself at 23.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I became a barber. And when I turned 24 is when I started my my first barbershop.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was 28
mm-hmm.
When I started my first healthcare company, and I built my second barbershop, and before I turned 30, I started my third healthcare company, and the story just kind of goes on,
right.
just kind of goes on from there. But that's a good walk, you know, through
right,
my life
right.
from the beginning to the present time.
This is a funny thing. I know in hindsight it's always funny, but at the time
mm-hmm.
when things were happening, it was not funny. But I thought
right.
what was funny was you cleared up the whole fridge to go in the fridge and be in the fridge because it was so hot at the apartment.
Right.
You remember that?
Right.
And you wrote that. I thought, when
I
read that, this is probably something that I would do myself. And what I was doing
right.
was when I was growing up in Malaysia, and it was hot as heck over there, and there's no way you can get away around that, okay? And
right.
what I would do is that I would take at least about 5 to 6 showers a day to cool down. So that's why I thought it was kind
wow.
of funny when you look back.
Yeah, it was. That was it was an interesting situation because, you know, like I said before, we were poor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I never realized how poor we were until I became successful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so we just learn early on, which is something that I write about in chapter one,
mm-hmm.
learning how to make do with what you have. You know, I know
right.
it sounds ridiculous to clean out the whole refrigerator, but we lived in a bottom apartment, and it was so hot, Johnny. I mean, it was hot. I mean, you ever walk into a house that's so hot that everything
yeah.
that you touch
yeah.
is hot?
Yeah, yeah.
And so the air had been broken, I think, for almost a year. It had been broken for a while.
Wow.
And we had a landlord that wasn't too responsible,
mm-hmm.
but needless to say, this night I just couldn't take it anymore because we had the windows up, we had the fans going, and I thought, well, you know what? I know one place where it's cool, the refrigerator. So I cleared everything out of the refrigerator, and I was kind of small, and I mm-hmm. got in that refrigerator and closed the door, and I slept like a baby. And but it scared my mother to death when she
right.
opened up the door.
Right.
But it was, you know, I was definitely cool.
Yeah. I brought that up because it was funny, and yet people need to understand, because a lot of times they don't understand that we are all ordinary people, and we can make a big difference along the way is how we chose what we want to do in life. So this brings us to the next question I want to ask you. You are currently in your mid-30s, and you have written a wonderful memoir. What prompted you to do this?
Well, when I was a young girl, Johnny, like I said before, I didn't have any, you know, prayers for cute little boyfriends and dolls and things like that. The one prayer that I did have is that I'd always prayed that I would never get sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I never knew why I prayed that prayer as a young girl, but as I got older and I continued to pray that prayer in my teens, I realized that, you know, life had let me live long enough to see cancer, you know, eat the bones of people who were kind-hearted and, you know, strokes, you know, paralyzed people and just, you know, just illness period ruin lives. So I never wanted to be sick. And in 2005, I was in my Nashville office, and an employee walked in, and when I looked up to address her, I could not see her. Literally,
mm-hmm.
I could not see her. And it was abruptly, it was without notice, and it was just like an instant shift in my life. And so in 2000, I was blind for 6 months, and fortunately my vision returned in February of 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And so from 2005 until 2008, my doctors had tested me for all these different diseases. And in 2008, I was finally diagnosed with a disease called Behçet's disease. Behçet's disease is a rare, multi-disabling blood disease, and it's extremely rare in the United States. There's only like about 10,000 cases of it, and it's even you know, I guess more rare. I don't know if those two words go together, but they will
mm-hmm.
today.
Mm-hmm.
It's even more rare amongst African Americans. And so Behçet's disease was the disease that I did not want, because over the years, all these different diseases that my doctors were testing me for, mm-hmm. you know, I would go home and I would research and look them up and so forth. And I remembered that Behçet's disease was a possibility. And I mm-hmm. used to always say, oh, God, I don't want that one. And lo and behold, that's the one that I was diagnosed with. Because mm-hmm. Behçet's disease, it can be fatal. And it mm-hmm. is oftentimes fatal for most people before you turn 37. And mm-hmm. I'm 36. Mm-hmm. And I had had, up until that point, all of the symptoms of Behçet's disease. And so I was just didn't know if I would be the one who would live past 27.
Mm-hmm.
And so especially since in 2007, I had a really bad flare-up, and I had to have surgery on my left eye. And in 2008, a little after I got the diagnosis, what was in my eyes was now I was dealing with in my entire body. Mm-hmm. And so to this date, as a matter of fact, when I finish this interview, I have to go to the Vanderbilt MS clinic because I take an infusion. And infusion treatment is mm-hmm. similar to a chemo treatment. Mm-hmm. And it's 4 hours for one treatment, and I do that once a month. Mm-hmm. So I knew then when I got the diagnosis that my prognosis was not going to be good. So I decided at that time, in 2008 when I got that letter, that I would, because at the time I had started 3 businesses, I had my first home, I had purchased my first home. I mean, life was just really good for me. I was mm-hmm. really happy. Mm-hmm. And I decided that in order to beat this, I needed to do 2 things. One was, I decided, because I didn't know if tomorrow was going to come for me, because things were really spiraling out of control with my health. So I decided that I was going to live passionate about the things that mattered to me.
Mm-hmm.
And writing is home for me. Writing is the thing that I am most passionate about. And the second thing was, I knew that in order to live with this disease and deal with, you know, this diagnosis, I needed to do something that I was afraid to do. And if mm-hmm. once you read my book, I mean, I know you have, but this is for the listeners. Mm-hmm. Once they read the book, they will learn that there is opportunities and obstacles if you face the thing that you fear the most.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I feared the most, Johnny, was in 1999, I had a chocolate cocker spaniel, and his name was, I named him Chocolate. And he was the world to me. I mean, the world to me. And he had a little accident, and he accidentally hung himself, and he died.
Mm-hmm.
And for all of those years, for 9 years, I never, ever wanted another dog mm-hmm. because I had to deal with that pain, and it was unbearable. And so for 9 years, I was afraid to even look at another Cocker Spaniel because that's the breed that I just mm-hmm. connect with. I just love them. And so when I got the diagnosis, I said, what I'm going to do is I'm not going to be afraid to love anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to waste another second because I don't know if tomorrow's coming for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to put off today. I'm not going to put off, you know, today what I could do tomorrow, however the saying goes. So I decided mm-hmm. that I was going to buy me another chocolate Cocker Spaniel. And I found a breeder here in Crossville, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And she not only had a chocolate Cocker Spaniel, she had a black one.
Mm-hmm.
And I called her and I told her, you know, my story and my situation. And I said, I'll be there in 30 minutes. She said, mm-hmm. well, I haven't even told you the price. I said, well, I don't need to know the price. This is going to help me get to where I need to be. I'm on my way.
Right.
So I went and I bought the 2 Cocker Spaniels. Mm-hmm. And the chocolate one, his name is Kramer. The black one, his name is Clifton. And about 3 months after that, I bought another one. Her name is Chloe. She's a blonde mm-hmm. one. And they are just the love of my life. And so that is why I decided to write this memoir.
Fantastic. Wonderful story. Your mom
yeah.
played a very important role in your life. She has a favorite
mm-hmm.
saying, and I love what she says. Earth has no sorrow that heaven can't heal. How has this wisdom served you over the years?
Let's see. Well, the first thing that comes to mind is it's all, heaven is always right. Mm-hmm. And for me, in going through, especially coming from, you know, poverty and dealing with racism, dealing with illnesses, dealing with setbacks, dealing with, you know, all the people that are mad because you're successful and they're not. I mean, just all the negative things that I've had to encounter in life, there was always something inside of me that said, stand.
Mm-hmm.
There was always something inside of me that said, you're good. There was always something that said, things don't have to be this way. And every time I went, you know, forth and I believed in that something, it was always right.
Mm-hmm.
And so every time I, you know, got myself in a bind or a situation occurred, I always trusted heaven. And so, and that saying, you know, that my mother would say, that earth has no sorrows that heaven can't heal, when I was younger, it was just a saying that, you know, I heard my mother say. But as I got older, Johnny, mm-hmm. and, you know, lived life a little longer,
mm-hmm. yeah.
I realized that she was right.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. Mm-hmm. It doesn't.
That's wonderful. You have several turning points in your life, major turning points. And one of
mm-hmm.
the ones that I picked out was the fact that you did a tremendous turning during your very young age, during your high
mm-hmm.
school years. Tell us about that high school graduation
yeah.
story. I think that's just tremendous because a lot of times we all tend to give up, or especially at that age, we tend to give up because this is something that you did personally and you made a conscious decision at that time.
Right. Yeah, that was definitely a turning point for me. It's interesting because even now that I'm 36, it just always feels like it was yesterday. When I think I was 18, and I was scheduled to graduate, and it was at the end of the year. I'd taken all of the graduation photos, participated in the graduation practice ceremony. That's, you know, a couple of days before you graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And a few days before it was time for me to graduate, I received a call from the guidance counselor that I needed to come to the office. And so when I went to her office, I just remember not having a care in the world. You know, it was at the end of the school year, my last year of high school, and I was just in a total, you know, another world. And she said to me, as I went in the door, she said, "Chautauqua, you're not going to graduate." And I remember almost feeling dizzy, like something's wrong here. I mean, I've sent out my graduation invitations. I have my class ring. I've taken my high school graduation photos. I've participated in the practice ceremony. There must be something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I actually said that to her, and she said, no. She said, you have a 69 in your chemistry class, and you need a 70. In order to have the 22 credits that you need to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So at this time, because you have the 69 in your chemistry class, you only have 21 and a half credits.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of gave me a little bit of hope because my chemistry teacher, his name was Mr. Lashley, and he was my all-time favorite teacher. So mm-hmm. I made my way to his classroom, and when I entered, he was grading papers. And so he looked up at me, and he said to me, well, what are you so happy about? And I said, well, I just came from the my guidance counselor's office, and she told me that I wasn't going to graduate. And I said that I have a 69 in your class. And I remember after saying that, I kind of giggled because I was hoping that
mm-hmm.
he would finish the sentence for me. And he looks at me like, okay, well, what do you want me to do about it? And so I'm still looking at him, and I say to him, well, I need a point. You know,
mm-hmm.
I have a 69 in your class, and I need a point to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me it wasn't really rocket science, you know, because if I didn't have this point, you know, I would not graduate. And I just
right.
couldn't imagine being so close but yet so far away. So he looks at me, and he says, so, Miss Webb, he said, well, what do you want me to do about it? And I said, well, it's just a point. And he says to me, yeah, it is just a point, but it's a point you didn't earn.
Mm-hmm.
And if I give you this point today, you will always expect someone to give you something for nothing. And I could tell, one, by the words that he said to me and by looking in his eyes, that he was not going to give me that 1 point.
Mm-hmm.
And in an instant, I just felt darkness all around me. I left his classroom, and as I was walking to my car, the right side and the left side of me was black.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just could not believe that something like that could happen to me. You know, 13 years of, you know, rising early and going to school, mm-hmm. and being a good student, I just could not imagine something like that could happen. And so I got home, and I was a mess. And so needless to say, it was in that moment, Johnny, that I learned that when you're going through a trial like that or a situation, mm-hmm. like that, you have to find whatever it is that's within that storm that suits you. And what, mm-hmm. I mean by that is I didn't have enough energy to deal with that kind of news, mm-hmm. and go and tell these 50 people that, hey, I'm not going to be graduating, don't go to the graduation.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided not to tell anybody. So everybody went to the graduation. And, you know, of course, going through the graduation practice ceremony, I knew that I was scheduled to go walk across the stage at 7:50,
mm-hmm.
and,
mm-hmm.
that the graduation ceremony would actually end at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
So around about 8:59, my phone was ringing off the hook because, see, I was still at home. I stayed at home,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that whole day. And so, needless to say, I never told anybody why I did not graduate, and they went on. But I did eventually share with my mother. I made up some story about having a speeding ticket, because even after it was over, I still did not have the strength to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that, you know, I would just stick with that and I would roll with that. So one day, I remember this was probably about eight months after everything had kind of settled in, and this thought popped in my mind. And that thought was, no does not mean never.
Mm-hmm.
Get up and try again. Because you did not graduate with your classmates does not mean that you're never going to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually found a summer school that I could attend that summer and get the half a credit that I needed. And the other thing that I learned when I was going through that situation, kind of similar to when I lost my vision, is I learned that when you're going through a situation, the requirements to treat other people the way that you want to be treated and be responsible for your own actions, they still stand.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, even, you know, in going through that tough time, I realized that Mr. Lashley was setting me up for success.
Right.
It was a point, but he was right. I didn't earn it. And so, needless to say, I went to the summer school, got my half a credit, and they had a graduation ceremony. And Mr. Lashley was the first guest that I invited.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to the graduation ceremony, he was actually my first guest there. So in 1994, I graduated from Cone Adult Learning Center, and I received my high school diploma. But it was definitely an interesting time. It was a trying time, but I really believe in my heart that it was the foundation that led me down the path that I am now journeying on.
And that's the reason why I brought it up, because the fascinating thing about it is that you had no reason to invite him. You could have, despite,
mm-hmm.
the fact that he did not give you that 1 point, but you realized,
right.
that in essence, in hindsight, that he helped you to be the person you are today. Of course, at that time, you kind of realized, you had the insights to realize that he meant well.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. He did.
Yeah, so that's fascinating. Another major turning point, as I read your book, which was very interesting, is that you had a spiritual awakening in Atlanta, Georgia. Please share that with us, you know, towards the tail end of your stay in Atlanta, where you, mm-hmm. made this tremendous change. And I think that touched you, I think, till today.
Mm-hmm. That is correct. I had moved to Atlanta in the year 2000, and one of the things that I would say that was the awakening for me is, and again, going back to responsibility, is that once you broaden your horizon and you see how other people in other cities do business, and you're able to see, you know, just how things operate on a broader scale, it within itself is enlightening. But the one thing that, you know, the awakening I would say for me is that I found that even though I was living in Tennessee and I had moved to Atlanta, was that the responsibility of taking control of the situation that you have, the cards that, you know, life has dealt to you, it all remains the same. So in Atlanta, I would say the awakening for me was really the confirmation that I was on the right path. Mm-hmm. And the barbershop that I worked in, it was the largest barbershop that I've ever seen in my life. It was a total of 14 male barbers. And I was the only female, so I actually made 15. And in this barbershop, there were five guys that owned it, and two of them were called spiritual dreads. And I'm not really sure exactly what their religion, exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, they really nurtured, I guess, my spiritual experience. And they would do things like they would leave literature and tapes and CDs and things like that on my barber station. And all of the information really pertained to, and I'll sum it up, but it pertained to respecting the fact that God is the highest level of intelligence. And that particular intelligence, if you break it all down, it all revolves around how you treat other people, the thoughts that you have about other people. And so my awakening there in Atlanta, I would say, is that it was really the confirmation that I got from the experiences, because it let me know that I was on the right path. And I think sometimes, Johnny, when you know, we live in a time, and I mean, even back then, those few years ago, it's kind of unpopular, right, to be so in tune to taking responsibility for your actions, for treating people equally, for, you know, mm-hmm. doing to others as you would have them do unto. It's kind of unpopular.
Right.
And so having to, you know, going there and seeing, okay, this is a much larger city, it's a much more diverse city, you know, than Nashville is, and to see that those same principles are alive and well, it was really confirmation for me. So I would say that was my awakening.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Another thing that was interesting is that here, I know in the book you were critical of yourself, the fact that you're only a high school graduate, but yet, mm-hmm. to me, what I found out is that you read a lot, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that you read, and this is interesting, don't get me wrong, because we all tend to stereotype a lot of things, whether, you know, whatever race you're in and so forth, but especially like your background growing up in the projects and everything else, and the fact that the people that you surround yourself with. And what's fascinating about it is that somewhere along the line, you read something about Margaret Thatcher, the former prime minister of
England. Right. Mm-hmm.
And
that's
fascinating,
right,
because she had a comforting statement that really touched your soul. Share that with us, please.
Right. I had – that's a great question, too, Johnny. I had moved mm-hmm. back to Nashville, because when I moved to Atlanta, I had seven goals that I wanted to accomplish, and the last goal was to move back to Nashville and open up and start my own barbershop. And so – but when I came back – for some reason, I thought since I had changed that the people here had changed, and they had not. Mm-hmm. And so within a matter of time, I had fell back into some of my old habits and hanging around some of, you know, the same people. Mm-hmm. And I began to beat myself up about it. And one day I was doing some reading and just, you know, just some thinking. And I thought about one of the quotes that I had read about Margaret Thatcher not too long ago, and that was, some battles you have to fight more than once to win. And so I said to myself, you know what, let's fight this battle a second time and let's win it. you know, versus waddling in it and giving up and beating yourself up, you know, beating yourself up about it. Because I realized going through that particular phase of growth in my life is that change is a process. And sometimes when you go through that process, it's not as quick as we would like it sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I was open, you know, once I read, you know, her quote, mm-hmm. I opened myself up to just really continue the changing process. But it was a very comforting and inspiring quote.
Another favorite line of mine in your book, which I really like very much, very, very inspiring, Oprah's energy demonstrated that her life was in line with her purpose. How did this resonate with you?
She has been such an inspiration to me in so many facets, you know. But how that resonated with me is because when you're in line with your purpose, it does not matter what the tabloids say about you. It does not matter, you know, the false allegations that people accuse you of. When you're in line with your purpose, your life will keep moving. Mm-hmm. And not only will it keep moving, it will keep shining. And not only will it keep shining, it will keep growing. And so the one thing that we all know about, you know, Miss Winfrey is that her life for 25 years that we've been, you know, had the privilege of, you know, watching her show and watching her on TV and reading the magazines and watching her in movies, is for 25 years her light has shined forth. Her, you know, her life has grown. And so when your life is in line with your purpose, no matter what comes against you, no matter what, you know, setbacks that you may encounter, your life will keep going. And so that's how, you know, that's what I, you know, got from her life being in line, you know, with her purpose.
People in Nashville, where Oprah Winfrey grew up and where you kind of grew up also, have compared
uh-huh.
you to each other. How does that make you feel?
Uh-huh. Oh, that is like an excellent compliment. and let me tell you why it's a great compliment. It's a great compliment to me, one, because I couldn't think of a better person. Mm-hmm. But secondly, it allows me, it's kind of confirming to me that people really see my spirit. Because you can build companies all day long, you can buy houses all day long and cars and all that kind of stuff, but at the end of the day, what people remember most is how you treat them.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate that compliment, but make no mistake about it, there will never, ever be another Oprah Winfrey. And I am grateful for the footprints that she has, you know, walked and mm-hmm. laid in the sand for women like me. And mm-hmm. I will always be appreciative to her for that.
One of the things I also got from reading your book, you do have mentors and so forth. Let's talk a little bit about that, because a lot of times people feel like they have to do it themselves. And sure,
mm-hmm.
there's certain things we can do ourselves, but then it's great to have mentors. And these mentors don't necessarily have to be some genius out there, because you can have so many different mentors in your life that, to me, as long as they contribute something positive in your life, and of course you have some, let's talk about that. Please tell us some
mm-hmm.
of your mentor stories.
Sure. Well, the one thing that I would say that's most important that I would like to share with the listeners is the teacher will appear when the student is ready.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I wanted to share that first is none of the mentors that I've ever had in my life were mentors that I was looking for.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, I guess it was just divine, and it was something that happened. But I think that for me, having a mentor is part, it's kind of the ingredient that goes along with, you know, your life, you know, being in line, you know, with your passion and,
mm-hmm.
and your purpose and so forth. Because there is no way in the world that any of us can be successful without having that respect for our elders, And I think that once I encountered, these business owners and spiritual advisors and people like that and so forth, I think once I encountered them, what made them connect with me is that the level of respect that I had for them. And I would not in no way, shape, form, or fashion be where I am today had I not had mentors, had I not had advisors. But make no mistake about it, an advisor and a mentor is not going to tell you the things that your friends tell you.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to tell you, oh, you did a good job, oh, you're so beautiful, oh, da, da, da. They're going to tell you the things that you need to know that can enhance your journey and help you move along a little bit further. One of the mentors that I had, in the very beginning of my career was a wonderful woman by the name of Renita Weems. Ms. Weems is a scholar, and she's also an author. She's a teacher, and she was phenomenal in the sense that she could take a situation that I just thought the world was going to end, and she could break it down in such a way in which, that I could digest it and I could move on from it. And so I believe personally that having a mentor or spiritual advisor or, any kind of advisor it's necessary, especially if you're going to move if you're seeking the highest heights within your journey, because I really don't know any other way that you could get there, other than having an advisor of some kind. And the other thing that having an advisor, it does for you, they allow you a safe place to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of us who are seeking some form of success, the one thing that nobody wants to do is mess up.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to mess up and they don't want to be wrong. And an advisor provides you that safe place to be wrong, to mess up, to fall down, to be insecure, to be open, share your truest feelings. And you're going to need that kind of support as you grow along. And that's actually one of the things that Renita Weems actually taught me, because when I first met her, I wouldn't say that I was closed, but I was really in tune to, my businesses and starting, the barbershop and starting something else. I was really in tune to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the things that she told me when we first started, when she first started mentoring me, was you have to have that community support.
Mm-hmm.
So I would highly recommend, if any of the listeners has the opportunity to connect with a mentor or an advisor, I would highly recommend that they do so. Highly recommend it.
Very exciting advice there. And one of the things also that I find, that you are a very spiritual person and you have lots of gratitude for all the things that you have and will have. And I think that's a lot to do with the things that we have today, because if we are grateful for the things we already have, more things will come our way because we generate positive energies out there. What additional things can you tell us about that from that perspective?
Right. Well, I guess for me, it's important. I'm very protective about my space.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm writing a blog article now, and it's about fear.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that people who ask me the question, well, you've done so many things, do you fear anything, or is there anything that you're afraid of?
Mm-hmm.
And the first thought that always comes to mind is when you are surrounded by people who celebrate you and not people who tolerate you, you don't have fear. Fear comes from being out of your league. It comes from being surrounded by a group of people who are negative or, don't do this because that's going to happen. But when you surround yourself around people who tell you, go for it, give it all you got, you're a great person, this, that, you don't have fear. And so for me, in keeping that sense of peace, I'm very protective about, who's in my space. I'm very protective about the things that I watch on television, you know, listening to the radio, even when I'm reading the news online, whether it's, you know, Forbes.com or, you know, MSNBC or whatever the case may be. There's always some information, well, such and such was just arrested for this or this happened. I always click past that. So I think having that piece, it comes from you know, protecting your space. But for me, it also comes from knowing that I'm not always going to be here. And I have, each day that I am here, I have the opportunity to live my life in such a way that at 4 o'clock today, something happens to me and I know that I'm getting ready to take my last breath, I can take it with a smile. You know, so every day, you know, I live my life in that fashion. So I would say that peace comes from working on myself every single day, working on the inside of myself, treating people the way that I want to be treated, and protecting the space that I'm in.
That's fantastic. Your message has a universal appeal, regardless of race, age, and social economic standing. What I like about it is that it covers every aspect of people's life of being spiritual. So what would you like your readers to get from reading your book?
What I would like the readers to take away from the book, Johnny, is it's okay. All these reasons that we come up with why we can't do this, why we can't go to the next level, why we can't succeed, all of those reasons don't matter. And in every obstacle is an opportunity. In every moment that, you know, someone, in, like when I got the news about when I first lost my vision and I went to the doctor and he told me in that moment, he said to me, it is a great possibility, Ms. Webb, that you're going to go blind forever. Well, in that moment, as dark as it was and as tragic as it was for me, I gave myself 10 seconds to wonder what life would be like blind, but I gave myself another 50 seconds to think about what life would be like when my vision came back. So in each moment, you have the opportunity to choose, am I going to live or am I going to die? And so what I would like the readers to take away from this book is that whatever you need for things to be all right, it's already all right. It's not going to be all right tomorrow. It's not going to be all right in 30 days. It's not going to be all right when you win $1 million. It is all right right now. And knowing that, that gives you strength. That gives you, it gives you power. And so I wanted to share my story so that people would know that, I mean, because I never even realized, Johnny, how tough of a time that I had until I started writing the book. Because to me, and I think I actually write about it in the book, trying was all I knew. All I knew was to try. And so, but once I look back and I said, well, you know what, if I can make it, I know people have heard that before, but I'm telling you, if I can make it, anybody can make it. So that's what I would like for them to take away with the book. It's already all right. And you can use those obstacles and turn them into milestones for your success.
Fantastic. I know your book is not due out nationally until July the 1st, and I'm so happy that I had the opportunity to get an advance copy. But where can someone go to get more information about you and also the information about your book?
Excellent. They can go to my website, and that website address is www.chitokaweb.com, and that's chitokaweb.com. And once they go to my website, there's all of the social media links, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and a couple others, and they can go to the Where to Buy page, and there are some links there that will show them where they can purchase the book. And there's a video trailer on the homepage that gives a little bit more information about the book, and there's more information about myself as well.
How has writing this book impacted you personally?
Oh, wow. It has impacted me personally tremendously, because when you when you are aggressive about, you know, living your best life, sometimes you don't realize the things that you have overcame until you stop and you reflect back on those things. And so once I finished reading the book, I actually said something to myself that I've never said. I've looked in the mirror and told myself, I love you. You're beautiful. I thank mm-hmm. God for you. But once I finished writing the book, because, you know, of course, when you write the book, you read it 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but once I finished, I went to my bathroom and I looked in my mirror and I said, I am proud of you, Shatoka. So it has impacted me in such a way that I know for sure that I will no longer have these, you know, some of the thoughts that ramble through my mind about doubt, which mm-hmm. is some of them I share in the book. So it has impacted me in a tremendous way, tremendous way.
That's wonderful. Now, you also have worked heavily with many organizations, and to name one is the YMCA. Why is that important to you?
That's important to me, Johnny, because I think success is not about what you take in but what you give out. And there's a different kind of energy when you give. You know, yeah, we're all excited if you go buy a new car or new pair of jeans, but there is a different kind of energy when you actually go out on your own personal time and you do things for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And not only is it a different kind of energy, it's an energy that lasts a long time. So to me, being successful is not all about what you can take in, but what you can give out.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to make sure that, you know, with all the writing, you know, doing my business and all the things that I do, I always have at least 2 or 3 organizations that that I provide, you know, time to, whether it be talking to someone on the phone, you know, whatever it is that they need me to do. But, you know, providing whatever it is, you know, it's just a different kind of energy, and I really appreciate it. And to me, I could not imagine living in a world where there's so much that we all can do, you know, right from your home, you know, even
mm-hmm.
if it's picking
mm-hmm.
up the phone and participating on the hotline. I mean, there's just so many things that you could do to give back to society. I just cannot, you know, see not being a part of that. So it's very important to me. It's something that I've always done and something I'll definitely always continue to do.
What's interesting, though, Shatoka, because of the fact that you have always lived your life like that, you actually work as a caregiver when you already owning your own business for a very long
right.
time. Yeah, and because
right.
of that, you actually got the inspiration to start the healthcare business that you have. I mean, you certainly did not go in there with the intent of trying to learn about the healthcare business, because you went there to give, and in return,
right.
you got so much back in return. So that's fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was not my intention. One of the reasons why I decided to keep the job, I was working third shift at nighttime. One of the reasons why I decided to keep the job is because I wanted to learn how to, you know, really shuffle and do more than one thing at one time. Because once I left the third shift job, I would go to my own business, and it was like a totally different world. I mean, at my barbershop at the time, I think I was bringing in maybe like $1,000 a week.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
being a caregiver, I was only making like $6.50 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
because I did not have any form of college or anything like that, I used that experience to really teach me how to be humble,
mm-hmm.
to teach me how to do more than one thing at, you know, at one time. And it paid off. It really did. It paid off.
And you never, again, expect to have a business in the healthcare industry, because you did it like, say, hey, this is a humbling experience for me. I just needed this. It balances me out. And lo and behold,
right.
there was a reason that you were led to do that. And that's fascinating.
Right. Right. Yeah, it really was, because I was trying to, at the time how I, you know, made the connection mm-hmm. with using what it was that I had to get to the next level. I was actually working that third shift job when I decided that I would build a new barbershop mm-hmm. for my customers because they had been so great to me. And, you know, not having any resources, you know, not having, you know, any credit, because mm-hmm. most of the things that I paid for with my first business, I paid cash for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I knew that this next business, I would have to have a whole new mind if I wanted
right.
a whole new reality.
Right.
And so, and that's when I went to work. You know, I went to work that night and I looked around and I can even see my facial expression now. And I looked around and I said, you know, I wonder if I could own a business like this. You know, and I knew it was a long shot,
mm-hmm.
but it was too late. I had already believed that I could. So I tried, and by the goodness of God, it actually worked out. It actually
Fantastic.
Worked out.
By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with all our listeners this morning?
I do. My recipe for living is one thing that is most factual, and that is nobody can live your life but you. Who you are and what you seek to become is nobody's business but yours. So own it. Own it. You know, it's your life. It's your journey. It was designed for you. And I think so many times, you know, we go through life and we go through these situations and we can't understand, you know, why this best friend is not happy that I got this new position. You know, why is this particular family member, you know, mad because, you know, I'm joining this organization, or all the things that you do that are successful in life. And when we encounter those people, we wonder, well, why would they be mad or be jealous or envious or angry? Because, you know, this is something that I'm doing to better my life. It's simple.
Right.
It's not their life. It's not
Fantastic.
Their journey. You know,
Fantastic.
So nobody can live your life but you.
Right. Fantastic. Chitoka, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Laurie Giles. Besides being an attorney, Laurie is also an author, a certified life redefining and transition coach, and a media personality. She specializes in helping women and men survive and flourish through life-altering situations and transitions. Laurie and I will be discussing about her life's journey, her book series titled What Now, and her unique, holistic, and synergistic approach to tackling life's sudden challenges. For additional information about this show, future shows, and to receive a free recipe for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening, and have a great week. Chitoka, thank you again, and have a great day.
Okay, thank you, Johnny. You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.